I would advise trying to find a combination of interest and skill. So you want to solve a problem that you care about, but you also want to solve something that you can solve. And also in a way that is sustainable for you as a person. So you have to have three things. You have to have a problem that you care about that's meaningful. You have to have the right skills, and you have to be able to do something, or at least start where you will think you can do something for a longer period of time.
Hello and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast bringing you the making of stories of successful software developers to help you on your upcoming journey. I'm your host, Tim Bourguignon. On this episode, I receive Feline Hermans. Feline is a full professor of computer science education at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam and a high school CS teacher. She's fascinated by how we can teach all people to program. She's also the developer of a programming language called Haiti that makes it easier for kids to learn textual programming. And we're definitely going to talk about Haiti today. Last but not least, she is the author of the book The Programmer's Brain, and she regularly writes in various publications and a radio show, I heard. Feline, welcome to DevJourney.
Hello.
But before we come to your story, I want to thank the terrific listeners who support the show every month. You are keeping the DevJourney lights up. If you would like to join this fine crew and help me spend more time on finding phenomenal guests than editing audio tracks, please go to our website, devjourney.info, and click on the Support Me on Patreon button. Even the smallest contributions are giant steps toward a sustainable DevJourney journey. Thank you. And now back to today's guest. Feline, the show exists to help listeners understand what your story looked like and imagine how to shape their own future. So, as is usual on the show, let's go back to your beginnings. Where would you place the start of your dev journey?
So I think the start is also an end for me, because this specific journey that I'm on now actually starts when I finished my PhD in software engineering. So I was in school for a very long time. I got a bachelor's and a master's and a PhD in computer science and software engineering. And then at the end of this, I was like, okay, where am I now, right? This was my path, was studying computer science, and I really like programming, and I finished everything. Now what, right? My planning of my life didn't really go beyond that. And then it was sort of like, I don't know, quarter life depression, one third life depression. I was like, I don't know, like, do I want to be a university researcher? Do I want to be a programmer? I don't know. I was sort of stuck. Also, in my personal life, my long-term partner and me broke up. So I was like, I don't know what to do. And then I started to teach in high school. And that's, I think, the moment where the rest of the current story will start.
Okay. How did it? Then let's start there. You are at this phase in your life where you don't know where to go. How did you decide, okay, let me start teaching in high school, or what I want to do next? How do you decide about this?
And so I didn't. The truth of it is that through networking, I already knew a few people in my neighborhood that were doing stuff with children, and they were starting a program in the high school to teach programming to kids within the high school program. Mandatory. So all 12-year-olds in the school would receive some programming lessons. That's country dependent maybe, but where I am, our high school starts at 12. And this specific high school in my neighborhood that I already knew about, they were starting this program. And some of them came to have a coffee with me and said, oh, you know, we know you have an interest in doing stuff with kids. Can you give us some advice on how to approach this? And we started chatting, and it was a nice conversation. And just out of the blue, without even thinking about it, I said, couldn't I teach one of the classes? I don't know. Like, I didn't stop to think, like, does this fit my schedule? Am I at all qualified to teach 12-year-olds? Well, I was not legally, and I was also not prepared in a practical sense. I didn't think about any of these things. It wasn't even maybe a decision. It just seemed like a thing I wanted. And I also didn't know if they would say yes. And they're like, yeah, sure. No, that sounds perfect. That's how it happened. It absolutely cannot be called a decision. it's more like it starts to rain. It's not a decision, right? It's just a thing that happened. This is a bit how I feel about this, which is also sometimes if people reflect on their life, they say, oh, and then this happened. Like there was a plan. Maybe there is for other people. But for me, no. I just didn't have anything more interesting or valuable to do because I was stuck. So it was definitely a result of me being stuck and being not satisfied with many things in my life. And I thought, I'm quite sure this is a thing I would enjoy. And I also saw that I would be adding value because the people from the high school, they were all not programmers. They knew for them that it was important to teach their students about programming, mm-hmm. but they didn't know anything about it. So I thought I would enjoy this. And this is a place where I can add value. And I think the specific type of stuck I was at that point in my life was that I didn't feel like I was adding value as a software engineering researcher. I'm not sure as a programmer, if you often read software engineering papers by software engineering researchers, they have quite a distance often to practice. And that's not to say that they are bad. Sometimes they have really good new algorithms and tools and ideas, but they're very far away from reality in a certain sense. So I just didn't feel like the stuff I was doing was actually helping someone. And I thought, well, teaching kids in a high school is very clearly helping the kids mm-hmm. because they will be right there. So it felt fun and valuable.
That makes a lot of sense. So you're hearing yourself saying, hey, can I teach? And people yeah. saying, yes. How'd you start from there? Did you have to build a curriculum? Do you have to start from scratch? Was yes. there something?
No, there was nothing. They were just starting this program. And the interesting thing, this is part of the journey as well, that I had experience teaching 18-year-olds programming in a university. So I had materials and I had plans and ideas. So I also thought, foolishly, how different can an 18-year-old beginner be from a 12-year-old beginner, right? I mean, you all have to explain to them what we're doing with Python. You all have to explain to them, print is the first command, and then you do brackets, right? And then you do quotes. It is the same level in a sense for any novice. So I thought, well, it's not hard. I have all my university stuff. I can simply just, you know, go a bit slower with 12-year-olds. Will be easy.
Did you have a chance to try that?
But this is what we did in the first year. It was not a success.
Tell me about it.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, so what I realized, not then, and now we're going a little bit forward in the journey, looking back, is that I think a lot of programming education is based on the idea that you do not tell people what is what. They have to figure it out by themselves. I was just reading, like, just before this meeting, a news article that came out somewhere early in the summer, where in Harvard, they will start to use an AI to teach programming. And it's so interesting if you read that article, maybe we can link it in the show notes, where they say, well, the AI is programmed to not give the example and give the answer. It's not Copilot. It's meant to lead the student to the answer rather than to just provide the answer. And then I thought, this is how I was thinking, right? I think many of us implicitly have this idea that it's never good to tell a beginner the answer. It's never good to tell a beginner how to do stuff. They have to figure it out by themselves. And there's quite a long history of reasons why that is the case, that if you want to, we could go there. But that was definitely the way I was teaching as well. And upon further reflection, this is also a bad idea for 18-year-olds. We have lots of dropout in universities everywhere around the world. 50% dropout out of computer science university programs. No one blinks. Right? No one bets an eye if you lose half of your students by February. So maybe it's also not good for 18-year-olds. But the difference is a 12-year-old that's confused will tell you, right? They're like, I don't understand anything. Whereas 18-year-olds, they go to their dorm and cry. And they're like, I am dumb. I don't know how to do this. They will not blame you. The 12-year-olds, they blame you for good reasons. So then after 1 year, I was like, no, this is not the right way. I will stick with it. I'm still teaching in high school, still every week, same place. They didn't fire me. But then after 1 year, I thought, okay, this was not the approach. I have to make some changes.
Mm. Before we get there, why do we keep on doing this even with university students if it's not the right way?
There are many reasons, right? I think one reason is this is how we were taught when we were kids, when we were students. So some people never reflect and they just do this automatically without looking whether it works, because this is the only form of teaching they might know is this form. Mm-hmm. And I also think other people might believe that programming is not for everyone. Some people might be somewhat happy with a 50% dropout because they say, well, programming is hard. It is not for everyone. So we're just weeding out the people that don't have the right brain, right? That don't have the right motivation or enthusiasm. So some people might not see it as a problem. And then it doesn't get solved, because if it's not a problem, what are we solving?
Mm-hmm. That's definitely the way I was taught. I'm trying to step back and see where my biases are. One of the things I always thought was that it was because we are always making sense of stuff we don't know, and in our day-to-day life, we're stumbling on problems and we have nobody around us to tell us how to get at it. And so I thought we were trying to replicate this early on to get used to that feeling.
So this is also a great point that you're making. This is also a reason why some people do it, because they think that the skills that you need in practice are also the way you should teach beginners. But then that doesn't really make sense. I mean, just something like reading a book, right? If you read a book now, you do not start in the upper left corner with your finger following the lines, right? That's mm-hmm. not a strategy you need as an adult. You can just open the book. You can glance at a page. You can quickly find something because you can read very lightly. This is what a professional does if they're looking for information. Imagine teaching a six-year-old reading. Yeah, you know, just look at the letters a little bit. That doesn't work, right? So the strategies that are useful for an absolute beginner are very different from the strategies that professionals use. And there's actually a swap there. This is called the expertise reversal effect, where beginners have to learn in a very structured, simple way, but experts learn in a different way. Experts actually do learn the way we think beginners learn. Experts do learn by struggling, but that's because they already know many things. If I get an error message in Python and it says syntax error, unexpected EOF, I know what syntax is. I understand what parsing is and why a syntax error happens. I know what EOF, end of file, means. So I can Google this. If I program in and programming language that's entirely unknown to me and I get an error message, I'm still bringing this knowledge base with me. And then I can say, oh, I can Google an error message. This is a strategy that works really well if you have 30 years of programming experience and you're learning your 15th language, but it doesn't work very well for a beginner. And I literally said this, like, I will put the blame entirely on me. I said this to 12-year-olds, oh, you get an error message. You can just Google the error message. Imagine taking syntax error unexpected EOF into Google. And then these kids, they're not even English speaking, they're Dutch speaking. So what even is the error message? Because there's also line 2 in the error message. And Python has this little pointer thingy, this accent d'aigu, I think in French, that starts to point at an error. So what even is the thing you put into Google? And all of these things I'm saying about 12-year-olds are also very true for 18-year-olds still.
It is indeed. It is indeed. Thank you for that. Having a 6-year-old or 7-year-old now since last week at home, who just learned to read, that makes a lot of sense. They did at school. They did something very fun during the parent meeting this evening, where the parents are invited. They gave us some kind of hieroglyphs, you know, some pictograms.
That's so cool.
Basically forced us to relearn how to read and say, okay, those letters don't make sense to you either now. So now let's start reading and understanding this. And this is how it feels for your kids.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah, exactly. This is so good. And this is also what it feels like to read programming code for the first time. Even if it has words that have a little bit of meaning, like if or for, it is like that. And if you don't teach from that mindset, but if you teach from the mindset that you would be teaching yourself a new programming language, many people will fail, but you would think it's them, right? You would think that they are the problem. They are just not smart enough, or they just don't want to be programmers enough. Mm.
And you're making gestures like the moving your yes. head right and left.
<What I'm doing.
laughs> I'm just giving the video feedback to you, the listeners as well. Yeah. So I know what the end result of this is going to be, but I would be interested in the way there. So end of the first year, you realize teaching 12 years old is not like teaching 18 years old. It just doesn't work this way. You probably have hints already of all that you described. How did you go from there?
Yeah, so there was one failure year in between, because from there I started to really, really be, well, maybe even obsessed by learning. I really wanted to know, how do people learn anything? Because if you study computer science, or even in a boot camp, in a more informal way of teaching, there's never a course on how people learn, which is weird, because as programmers we always say, oh, you know, you will never stop learning. You will have to learn many new programming languages during your career. But in no way do we prepare people for actual learning. They don't know anything about learning. And therefore, the learners themselves, the students, also absorb these ideas about learning as struggling and exploring. And I don't know anything about learning. I have no mental models for learning. And I started to read a lot about how people learn anything, which is funny now, but then I almost lost my job because I wasn't being very productive because I was reading all of these books about learning. And then some of the things I learned, we already hinted at earlier in this conversation, you have to practice a lot. You have to do really small things, like exactly like your kid is learning letters. Maybe they have 1 week devoted to the letter A, and that's all they do.
Indeed.
And then this takes 26 weeks and then they only know letters, right? So it's really step by step. So then I thought, okay, this is how I should teach programming. We have to practice. So we do 1 week, it's only print, bracket, quote, hello in my language, hello, quote, bracket, that's the week. And they don't do it behind the computer. They do it on worksheets, on paper, just 100 times, print. Next lesson, 1 week, only variables. And the interesting thing about that is it did work really well. Kids learned programming a lot better than in the old situation because we were basically just drilling in all the concepts. They made a lot less syntax errors because they were practicing, right? If you want to memorize a poem in Japanese or something, you can do it. If you just do it all the time, you will be able to memorize it if you spend effort. So in that sense, it was working. But also unsurprisingly, kids did not really like this very much. Which, and it wasn't even so bad, right? Maybe you might now think, oh, this is terrible. But it's much like other high school subjects that they were exposed to, right? The next hour in German class, they would also do worksheets and repetition. So it wasn't outside of, let's say, the Overton window of teaching methods that they were used to. But they were also saying, we want to have more time in the computer. We want to make things, right? We want to do something. And that, I think, is such an interesting tension that I still think about a lot. On the one hand side, we want programming education to be creating something, because we like to build stuff. But on the other hand, I also wanted them to practice in small steps. And there's a little bit of like stretch, a little bit of conflict mm-hmm. between mm-hmm. that. Because if you want to build something of reasonable size, of reasonable interestingness, you already need to know many things. So you cannot build interesting programs and also learn concepts in an approachable way at the same time in current programming languages. So that was year two. Still a failure, less of a failure, because I did think I am going in the right direction. It is better than it was. We should step away from this free form exploration, teaching too many things at the same time. Really, this, maybe this is also how you were taught, like, this is a variable, this is a loop, this is a condition. Now print all prime numbers under 150. Yes. How? Like, no one told me what the strategy is to create a program like that. I have nothing to grasp onto. So I was like, that's not good. But then sort of the pendulum swung all the way the other way. Rote practice, rote memorization works, but it takes away too much of Like you don't retain the fun that people have, like this sparkle that I had when I was 10, just saying something like Prince Feline, and then it would say Feline, hello Feline. It's like, I am the master of the machine, right? You also want to retain that. So then again, I started to deep dive into learning. And this is, again, I was thinking, if we teach languages, we teach small subsets with rules where we are lying a little bit, right? We just say all letters are the same. Yeah, your kid, maybe they don't even know capital letters yet. We don't talk about capital letters in year three. We only talk about, you know, small letters or big letters, doesn't matter. But usually you pick one set of 26 and the other ones just, they just don't exist. We don't talk about them now. And that's not only true for language. It's also very true for math, that we take subsets with rules that aren't exactly complete. Like if you have subtraction, you probably start with the cookie mental model. You say, oh, there are 5 cookies on the table and 3 kids. I give every kid 1 cookie. How many cookies are on the table? 2. Now let's reverse this. I have 3 cookies on the table and I have 5 kids and I want to give everyone a cookie. How many cookies are still on the table? 0. Because after 3 cookies, we're out of cookies. Mm-hmm. And we don't say you have now -2 cookies dead to the cookie bank. No, we just say in the cookie mental model, 3 - 5 is 0. And sometimes we even change our lingo a little bit. In English, you usually say to younger kids, 5 take away 3. In my language, instead of saying min, which is minus, we say eraf, which also means away. So we say 5 eraf 3. So this, the way we talk about concepts reflects the mental models. Then I thought, this is an interesting idea. I know someone that actually has taken 5 courses in compilers and did an entire PhD in parsing and processing programming languages. Someone like that could actually make a programming language that has small subsets with only a little bit of the concepts and an easy syntax that is, in a sense, lying to the kids. It's not representing the whole language, but it is small enough so that they can learn it with a little bit of rote practice, not a lot of rote practice, but just a little bit. It is powerful enough so that they create something that sparks the fun, like, oh, it prints my name, or we have the turtle, or, oh, you can make something that draws a little bit. So I thought, I can make this. It's like a Hollywood movie, right? It's like, ah, I trained for this. Like, this is my destiny. So I thought, oh, I can build this. And then I did. I did build that programming language. And that's, of course, what ultimately became the heady programming language. That is a language that I call a gradual language that has, it's basically a set of, we now have 18, a set of 18 different sub-languages of increasing complexity, both in terms of concepts and also in terms of syntax. And that had never existed before. There were languages, Grace, for example, and Racket, that have sub-languages. That is not something that was unheard of, but sub-languages with syntactic variation as well. It was an entirely new idea.
And we're going to get there in a minute, but first I want to jump back a little bit. So you said you stumbled upon this job of teaching high school because didn't know really where to go. When Hedy started emerging into your mind, did you still wonder, is this the right path for me, and search for something else, or you were invested already and this was just the ball rolling down?
And so I was invested. So I was definitely invested in solving this problem of teaching this group of 12-year-olds that I had in front of me every year, teaching them better. So that was definitely a problem I was very much involved in. But it wasn't my plan to make this into something researchy or to build something. I just wanted to teach them better. I wanted to improve me as a teacher. But then I came in with this idea of building a language, and then it became, let's say, double the fun. Because I really liked teaching and I was really invested in solving this problem. And I could also solve it in a way that I really liked, that is building a programming language. So that just made it even more fun because I thought, in retrospect, if you do want to look at it like it was a trajectory, which it wasn't, I knew I had the skill of building a programming language. And this is what I wanted to do because I just really freaking love building programming languages. The most fun that can be had on this planet is building a programming language. But I didn't have a problem to wield this skill at that I thought would be valuable. And the stuff I was working on, like building a programming language for the finance industry, this is what my PhD thesis was mainly aiming at. I just didn't care so much about investment bankers making their spreadsheets a little bit better. Like I liked the solution, but I didn't love the problem. Whereas now I had a problem that could be solved with a programming language that I really cared about. And I also really truly believed that a programming language was a way this problem could be solved. I still also think there are other ways you could have better worksheets and more practice and other things. There are other solutions also, but now there was a solution that was in my realm of possibilities that I thought, okay, this will help and I know how to do it.
Okay, so let's jump on that train then. So you described Haiti so far as a language with 18 sub-languages. So I understand some kind of incremental steps into the language that remove complexity, remove some of the vocabulary that is not necessarily, remove some unnecessary syntax at some point, just to make it simple in a subset of the language, and gradually insert all those elements to come to Python?
Yes. That's exactly right.
Okay. And so you had this idea emerging in your mind, and you had probably a few months before the next year start. How did that go?
Actually, I had just 2 weeks because we have half years because the kids just take half a year of programming because they also take half a year of technology. So I had one Christmas break, the Christmas break from 19 to 20, in which I started to build my prototype. It was like a little bit before the Christmas break. So let's say I had like 3 weeks to build the first prototype before the next group was going to start. Ultimately, it was 2020, so it was the pandemic. So stuff was mildly different, but we didn't know then. So the first version that I built was just three levels. It didn't have syntax highlighting. Like nothing was there yet, but I just had three levels running with an editor, and you could edit in the browser because you don't want to install stuff in schools. And that was the first prototype that we started to test with.
So can you give us an example of how the first level, what the first level looks like?
Yes. So the first level in that then just had three commands. So one command is print, and it doesn't have brackets and quotes. So you just say print hello Tim, and it just prints hello Tim. Mm-hmm. And from the first level, I also wanted to have a little bit of user interaction so that you can create something with where a user is envisioned. So I also have the command ask. This is a little bit like input. So you can say ask, what is your name? And then you get a pop-up saying, what is your name? And you can fill out an answer. And then in level one, we also have a command called echo, and that repeats the answer. So you can say print, hello to this program, ask, what is your name? Echo, hello. And then it will simply at the end say echo. You do Tim, for example. The final command echo will say hello, Tim, because that's the answer. So it has state, it has a variable, but it's not openly available to the user how to get to that variable. But then you can create a program that already has a little bit of customization. Because just saying print hello, kids will say, and this is a good question, why do I type print hello? I can just open Word and print hello, right? Why would I do print hello to print hello? There's no logic there. So you want to make something where not only are they building something fun, they also see why they're building the thing, right? And just print alone doesn't show them what a program can do that Word cannot do.
So you're introducing the concept of a command that is a fixed word that they will have to use.
Yep.
Do you get some questions? Why the English print? Because you're teaching it in Dutch, right?
Yes. So that's a great question, sort of hopping forward in the story a little bit. So after these first tests with kids, I asked them like, okay, you know, how was this? Did you like it? What can we improve? And then indeed, kids said, why are the commands in English? Why aren't the commands in Dutch? Now, print is print, so this is easy. And echo is echo, spelled the same, so that is easy. But ask is vraag, so it's a different word. And then they were like, yeah, why not? You built this. Why don't you build it in Dutch? I was like, well, there exist other kids. And I wanted also, of course, to other kids to be able to use it if they wanted to. But everything else from the beginning had been localized. So the explanation that we build in and the error messages, all these things were bilingual from the start, because I figured you cannot show Dutch kids English error messages. I tried. It didn't really work very well. So it was a fair question of them to say, well, why not? So, well, why not? I have to build it. That's why not. It sounds like a lot of work. But then, of course, it was really, really hard, right? It's just duplicating the grammar and swapping out the words. And the interesting thing, Haiti is an open source project that lives on GitHub, is that once we had Dutch keywords, people started to supply other languages as well. French, Spanish, German, Italian, Greek. And then I thought, affiche, I think, is French for print. I thought, oh, yes, if your word for print is affiche, then this is a lot further from print than print. So the farther we got from languages sounding like English, the more I was convinced that it was actually useful. And a little bit further down the line, we also started to introduce non-Latin languages. The first there we had were Hindi and Bengali. They offer translations in non-Latin languages. I thought, wow, this is so cool. Yes, of course, if your language is Hindi or Japanese, how much more difficult is it to do Python? Imagine a Python lesson. Yes, the first command is print. It starts with a P. And now your kids in India are like, you know, what is a P and how does it differ from a B and a D? And in India, probably kids know a little bit about English because of their history. But there are many places in the world where a 12-year-old might have some familiarity with Latin letters because, you know, they are everywhere. But enough to easily distinguish the letters that you need, just like the hieroglyphs you were talking about in your PTA night. That's the same thing, where you can do it, but it just takes much more effort. And then I thought, yes, this makes so much sense. And now we have 47 different languages, many non-Latin, and we also support the right-to-left languages. So we also have Arabic and Hebrew and Urdu. So that was more programming effort. But the further away we got from English, the further away we got from the Latin alphabet, the more useful I saw. So this was really due to the 12-year-olds being like, hey, you should do this, and me reluctantly implementing it. And this is why it matters to have good conversations with your users.
So, first of all, congratulations. This is awesome.
And thank you.
Then you meant it in the further from English, the more valuable. You meant it because it's showing you the hidden steps that were in the way for the 18 years old, yes, to learn Python directly, right?
Yes. Yeah, and of course, me growing up with Dutch, which is very, very close to English and shares the same alphabet, you never really realize how hard it is to read in a different alphabet. Like, imagine, assuming you don't know Japanese or Arabic, you look at it and you're like, what, right? How? But then for them, this is how they look at our language, a little bit less so because English is just so everywhere. But imagine how hard it is. Like, I now sometimes I'm debugging Arabic programs. So people send me a screenshot in Arabic of a thing that doesn't work in Hindi. And I have this sheet of Arabic letters. I'm like, I don't even, you can't copy paste because it's a picture. It's like, why is this an error? What even are the letters? And then Arabic has this interesting thing where the letters are connected to each other. So I don't even see where the letters are. But you can only know this if you take a position from somewhere else. I would have never been able to think this way, because for me, the Latin alphabet is just the alphabet. Mm-hmm. All other alphabets are weird to me. So you don't see that. Like, the summary is, you don't see your own biases. You never see this unless people are like, tap on your shoulder, like, hey, but what about Hindi? And you're like, what? What about Hindi? Oh, now I get it.
How did you decide how this set of sub-languages should build on top of each other? What's the right sequence?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there it shows that I think Hedy is two things. So it was, one, solving this practical problem in my classroom, but also from the beginning, I was interested in building such a language for the sake of demonstrating that it could be done. So I also didn't think about it so much because I thought, I'm just pioneering a prototype that shows that it's possible and viable, that it works with these kids and that it's technically viable to build something. It doesn't really matter all that much which trajectory I choose because I'll put it out there and people can look at it and they can just, you know, fork this on GitHub and make their own trajectory. Because at that point, I didn't think it would be a platform with users. That's not a thing I considered. And we now have more than 300,000 users a month. So it's like, but I didn't build that, right? That happened, but I didn't build that. Had I known that, I would have thought more about the exact trajectory. But my reasoning for putting it just online and putting it on GitHub was, I'm just going to show what I do in class. So my trajectory is more or less the trajectory that we had in Python, which I thought about a little bit. There's like some sense and logic. We do variables, then we do lists, because they're also like variables, but a little bit more powerful. Then we do conditions, then we do loops, then we do functions. I think there's some sense in that, but I definitely also think other trajectories could be possible. I just mimicked my existing Python trajectory onto Python. And there are other choices to be made. But yeah, it's good that I didn't know, I think, because I would have had this paralyzing fear of getting it wrong had I known that this would be, for many people, the way to teach programming. But I didn't know. And now we have what we have, and it's very hard to change it because legacy.
But I think it's doing quite a good job, so it's a good legacy.
Yeah.
I had a question. I forgot it. Yeah. When you teach this 18 steps class, how long do you take for that? You spoke about introducing a concept a week at the beginning of the story. Are you still there, or did this change and you do it differently now?
No, so I have about 20 weeks with the kids. So my 18 levels more or less map to 18 weeks in the system that we have. That is 3 hours every week that I have with the 12-year-olds. And that's more or less what we still use. The earlier levels tend to go a little bit slower because kids also need to get used to the mechanics of programming. Like you have to go to a website, you have to log in, you have to click the button and then the code runs. What do you do when an error message appears? In some cases, 12-year-olds also have to figure out how to click things with a mouse because they only play on their phones and tablets and they don't really mouse or keyboard a lot. So the earlier levels tend to take a little bit longer per week, and then the later levels go a little bit quicker because then it's really just about the concept and not also about some other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you deal in your class with differences in speed of the of some students going way faster than the others?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there too, I have learned many things. Initially, my attention would be drawn to the quicker kids because they would be asking the more interesting questions. And they would look like kids, they would look like me, like kids that are obsessed with programming and that really like it. So I tend to, upon reflection, again, not seeing that then, I tend to spend maybe half of my time with the kids that needed me least, right? They already liked programming. Very often they advanced at home because they would just continue with the work alone or together or with their parents. Whereas the kids that really needed me, that were struggling, they didn't ask many interesting questions. They just like looked around really frustrated and confused. And then also I thought like, why am I teaching, right? Am I teaching to help the kids that already like programming, that already want to choose this as a topic? No, that's not why I thought this was interesting. I thought it was interesting and valuable to teach the other kids. So what we have now inside the Headi platform, as a teacher, you can customize all levels. So you can change the lesson plans. You can upload your own lessons if you want to. You can remove our lessons or reauthor our content. And you can also close disable levels. So you can say only level 1, 2, and 3 is available and the rest is not available. It's just blocked. You go to level 4, it says your teacher hasn't made this available for you yet. You don't have to use this, of course, but as a teacher, I really like this because the kids that go really quickly, you might think, oh, you know, just let them go. But the effect of them on the rest of the classroom is not neutral. Imagine being a kid stuck in level one, sitting next to someone that's already a level 10, looking at you like, what? And these are 12-year-olds, like, why are you level one? You're so slow. And this is also not neutral. Like, who's most likely to already have prior knowledge and enthusiasm for programming? White boys from middle-class families, right? Because their dads bring them to programming clubs. Their dads, when they're 2 months old, put them on their lap and say, we're going to do programming, right? So they are just a lot more likely to already have some experience and therefore go quicker. Who is least likely? Girls, kids from disadvantaged families where there's not a computer, so they don't have computer skills, so they're just a little bit slower in the beginning because maybe they're computering for the first time. Those type of kids are less likely to have prior knowledge. So if you let everyone free, it's very likely, if you don't do anything, that you will reestablish a power dynamic in which all the white boys are like, ha, this is so easy. And all the other kids are like, oh my God, programming is so hard. And then they will drop out, right? So you don't do this intentionally. I didn't do it intentionally, but upon reflection, I was always chatting only with the white boys because they were super interested. And my school is a very much a mixed school, which is fantastic, but I wasn't doing the other kids a service. So the way I deal with it is, if the difference between the highest and the lowest performers is too big, then the highest performers, they go do something else. Like, do you have math homework? Do you have German homework? Do you have geography homework? Go do that. You don't have any of that? Read a book. Do not bother me so that I can spend my energy on the kids that just need a little bit more practice to catch up. And then together, we will go to level four. And then the kids do not always like this. But, you know, kids don't like eating broccoli. They want to have pizza for breakfast. It is our duty to make them do what is important and good for them, good for us, good for everyone, ultimately. So they don't like it, but I don't care.
This is a lovely explanation. Thank you. This is really, really, really how it should be, actually. And not this elitaire way of teaching, just going with the fastest and not caring about the rest. So.
Yeah. And really also this had to do with how I perceived me, right? Because I was a girl when I was a kid, but other than that, I ticked all the boxes. So when I went to university, I also had kids around me that didn't know a lot of programming. I also thought, oh my God, you're so slow. You are so stupid. How do you not know all these things? And then, of course, you get older. Like, how did I know all these things? Well, my parents bought me a computer when I was 10. And this is 92. Who got a computer then, right? So that was such a privilege. I went to a very elite high school that had a programming club in the high school. Every week I could go to my math teacher and we had like computer club in the school. And I was like, didn't you have computer club in school? And I was like, no, no rich white girl. Not everyone has a computer in the school. Not even a computer club, right? So only later I realized how much was available to me, where I was still perceiving myself as this genius child. I'm so smart because I taught myself programming. No, like half the school taught me programming. I was just there.
This question is going to be very rhetorical, given the energy you have when you talk about it. But do you see yourself doing this for the rest of your career now?
Teaching in high school, you mean, or working on Hedy? Those are two different parts of me.
Maybe both.
Yeah, so teaching in a high school. So I taught for 6 years, and that's for us the entire duration of the high school. So my first generation is graduating now, and I might transition to a slightly different role in the school system, where instead of I will still teach one class next year for sure. But then my other hours in the school, rather than teaching again 12-year-olds as I've been doing this year, will probably be spent on helping other schools in our school district also adopt our way of teaching, which I do think is less fun. I'd rather teach again another batch of 12-year-olds this year, but I do see the value in helping others and scaling this system because we see it works so well and kids are benefiting. So at least for the coming year after the summer, I will work a little bit more at the school district level rather than at the school level. But I do see that for myself as like something to kickstart other schools. I definitely want to like keep teaching and teach more rather than less. And then working on Hedy, yeah, you know, I sort of have to now, right? We have customers. Well, it's free product, but still. I would say whether I like it or not, we have schools, we have 3-year returning schools now. So for the third school year in a row, the same teacher comes back and creates 3 new classes and teaches again. People are starting to depend on Hedy being there and sort of magically, from their perspective, get better every season. They send me emails, say, "Oh, so many things have changed and it's so nice. But also, here are some other things we would really like." So, you know, sort of software can have two states, I guess. Either no one uses it and then you're sad, or many people use it and then you're also sad.
But in a good way.
But in a good way. No, I mean, I love it. I love getting emails from literally all around the world, like South Africa, Latin America, Pakistan, Afghanistan. People emailing me saying, "We are using your software and it works." And they're like, "Oh, this is just fantastic." But also, yeah, I don't think it's really a choice whether I want to work on it. It's just a thing that exists, and it needs still a lot of effort. There are so many ways in which it could still be made better that I know I have the skills for and I really want to work on that. At least for a few more years, I will put my energy there because it has so much value.
It does indeed. It does indeed. To end the conversation, I like to put a twist on it. So you're also a professor in a university. Imagine you have a 25 years old PhD graduate student coming to you, and like you said at the beginning, saying, "Hey, the trajectory I was on is just finishing now, and yeah, I have no idea what to do next." What would be your advice at that point?
So I would advise, try to find a combination of interest and skill. So you want to solve a problem that you care about, but you also want to solve something that you can solve. Like, I also really care about climate change, but I don't have the professional skills to do much there. So, you know, I can protest. I do protest. I can not fly and not eat meat and not own a car. Those are things I can do, but that's not my career because I don't have the skills in my career. So you want to find a spot of a problem that you care about where you have also gained skills that you can contribute meaningfully. And also in a way that is sustainable for you as a person. I read this great story from Bert Hubert. He's a Dutch like IT activist. He was also in this "what do I do with my life" phase. And he started to do Python training at universities so that not non-programmers like biologists would get better at doing data analysis. And he was seeing that he could do it. He had the skills. He was solving a problem that he thought was valuable. But then still after years, like, "I don't like this because it's only sending emails and planning and booking tea," right? So you have to have three things. You have to have a problem that you care about that's meaningful. You have to have the right skills. And you have to be able to do something, or at least start where you will think you can do something for a longer period of time. Like, I do complain about having to close pull requests every week. I know I'm complaining about that, but it is also sustainable pace, especially now this year, it's sort of getting a little bit more quiet. So I see myself doing this for a few more years. And I think those three things are definitely what I would advise to a person. What do you care about? What can you do about it? And can you do this in a way where it will not burn you out or frustrate you? Because then it doesn't make sense either to do it.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Valine, where would be the best place to continue this discussion with you?
So you can go to Hedy, www.hedy.org, where you can try Hedy for free. We're also on GitHub. This is linked on the website. Maybe even the better place to go to would be hedy.org/join, where we also have a link to the Discord if you want to check. We also have a link to adding translations. If one of your languages that you speak is not yet in our set, you can help us translate as well. So hedy/join is a way that you can continue the conversation about Hedy. I have a website. It's valine.com. I am on Twitter, but I try to not be on Twitter, but I can help myself. And my ad on Twitter is just @Valine, so that's easy, but I might not be there forever.
Guilty as charged. I quit the bird a few weeks ago. So yeah, don't assume you will be there for a while. Valine, anything else you want to plug in?
No. Hedy is like the most important thing people should check out.
And I'll add all this in the show notes. So just scroll down and click. You'll have all the links there. Feline, thank you so much. It's been a fantastic ride.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been another episode of DevOps Journey. And we'll see each other next week. Bye-bye. Thanks a lot for tuning in. I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode. If you like the show, please share, rate, and review. It helps more listeners discover those stories. You can find the links to all the platforms the show appears on our website, devjourney.info/subscribe. Creating the show every week takes a lot of time, energy, and of course money. Would you please help me continue bringing out those inspiring stories every week by pledging a small monthly donation? You'll find our Patreon link at devjourney.info/donate. And finally, don't hesitate to reach out and tell me how this week's story is shaping your future. You can find me on Twitter. I am at Timothep, T-I-M-O-T-H-E-P, or per email, info@devjourney.info. Talk to you soon.